Isaiah 10:16 through 10:19 review, and Isaiah 10:20 through 10:34, the 12th talk in a series on the book of Isaiah, was presented by David Crabtree on May 30, 1999, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Before, but I still believe it to be true, it's a strange God that we serve. He is very mysterious, and it's hard to figure out oftentimes why he does what he does. As I've been working my way through Isaiah, I've been reminded of how stingily sometimes the Bible yields up its secrets. God could have written a clearer work. God could have found a way to communicate to us what he wants to communicate to us in a way that would be much more accessible. But he didn't. He hasn't done that. The Bible is constructed in such a way that it only yields up its secrets with lots of care and attention. And I find that it takes me, I have to go through passages several times over long stretches, oftentimes before it seems like it's really starting to tell me what it has to say. I don't think that that's entirely an accident. In order for the Bible to speak to us, we have to be very persistent and motivated listeners. We really have to want to know. And even then, it comes slowly and with difficulty. In Isaiah, what I've been finding is that on the one hand, he's writing in a poetic form, so I have to grant him poetic license. But on the other hand, when is he giving me clues that I need to go in a different direction, that he's saying something different? And I'm going to go back and redo a section of what I did last week. And I was forced to go back because last week Logan raised the challenge of having me explain what the destruction with overflowing with righteousness is in verse 22. So in order to answer that question, I had to go back into an earlier part of chapter 10. So let's look again in chapter 10 at verses 16 through 19. Let me remind you of how we got to this section in chapter 10. In 9, God had said that there are going to be these afflictions that will come upon Israel and Judah because of their rebelliousness and their unrighteousness. And he lists in 4 stanzas the things that are going to befall them because of that. And all of those things that he describes match fairly well pain and suffering that was inflicted upon Israel and Judah at the hands of the Assyrians. So God decided to punish Israel and Judah because of their arrogance and rebellion using Assyria. But then he talks about, starting in verse 5 of 10, he says Assyria is going to be punished because of its arrogance and rebelliousness. And so the rest of chapter 10, 10, 5 through through 19 is addressed to Assyria, describing what will befall them because of their arrogance and rebelliousness. Okay, starting in 16, though, I began to wonder, as I was pondering this stuff, whether this metaphor that he sets up of the fire is talking about something that has already happened to Assyria or that is yet to happen to Assyria. And there are several reasons why I began to wonder that. The first is, let me read just verse 16 and explain the problem. Therefore the Lord, the God of hosts, will send a wasting disease among his stout warriors. And under his glory a fire will be kindled like a burning flame. And then it goes on developing that metaphor of the flame, like developing it into a forest fire and taking out the whole forest. Okay, in 16, are those two different metaphors, two different things that are going to happen to Assyria, or is it one thing being explained in two different ways? Is there going to be a wasting disease among his stout warriors, which he then goes on to elaborate on and say that that disease will spread like this fire? That's one option. The other option is that he's talking about something that is different, that they are going to have this wasting disease, and there will be this other affliction, which is akin to a fire. This is the kind of interpretive choice that I'm talking about, that you face constantly in Isaiah, where it could be that it's just that it's going to be this wasting disease, and that he's just describing it with this fire, and he's using poetic terms to describe it. But there are some things in his metaphor of the wasting fire, of the fire, that don't seem to match what historically happened, that then lead one to believe maybe this is not describing the wasting disease, but is rather something that is yet to befall the Assyrians. Here are the things. First of all, it says that, and the light of Israel will become a fire, and his Holy One a flame. So this fire in the metaphor starts with just this little flame that is associated with the light of Israel, and let's see, the light of Israel and the Holy One are the two terms that are used. Okay, is that an appropriate description for what happens with the disease? Maybe, maybe not. Second thing, in verse 19, and the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number that a child could count, a child could write them down. So this is going to be absolutely devastating. Is that what happened? Maybe, maybe not. The disease, well, we'll talk about it later. Okay, so I began to wonder, maybe we have a switch here. Maybe what is talking about with the disease is one thing, and the flame is talking about another affliction that will befall Assyria. And later in chapter 10, my thinking was reinforced, and we'll get to that in a minute. The first part about the wasting disease. Something happened when Assyria attacked Judah, and it's not clear what happened. Let's look at 2 Chronicles 32, 20 through 22. Now, the Assyrians, the king of Judah had made an agreement with the Assyrians. The kingdom of Judah would be allied with the Assyrians in exchange for their protection from the Assyrians. But at a certain point in time, Hezekiah decided to rebel against Assyrian power. Pardon? 2 Chronicles 32:20. I'm sorry. Hezekiah rebelled against the Assyrians, and the Assyrians ended up attacking the kingdom of Judah. And they conquered much of Judah, most of the major cities of Judah, and began to besiege Jerusalem. And it was looking grim for Jerusalem. And that's when this happened in verse 20. The king Hezekiah and Isaiah, the prophet, the son of Amos, prayed about this and cried out to heaven. And the Lord sent an angel who destroyed every mighty warrior, commander, and officer in the camp of the king of Syria. So he returned in shame to his own land. And when he had entered the temple of his God, some of his own children killed him there with the sword. So the Lord saved Hezekiah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem from the hand of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and from the hand of all the others, and guided them on every side. So something happened. God sent an angel who destroyed every mighty warrior. And there is some reason to believe that this may have been a disease. So the Assyrians are camped just outside of Jerusalem. They've besieged the city. They have put a lot of pressure on Jerusalem. And then one night, they're gone. Presumably, disease came. According to some other accounts, the Assyrians left because of rumors of rebellion back in the capital. But here all it says is that an angel came and destroyed every mighty warrior. So if this is a disease, this fits well what we have in Isaiah, that a wasting disease came and killed the strong, the stout warriors. But does the fire metaphor match that well? And I pointed out some reasons why it may or may not. But let's look at this fire metaphor a little bit more closely and try to dissect it. It says, "And under his glory a fire will be kindled like a burning flame." His glory, apparently when it says his glory, it means his army, his armed strength. There are a couple of other places where that same phrase is used with respect to a king and his glory. Let's see. And I think I wrote it down. In 8:7 of Isaiah, here it's talking about what will overflow. I think, if I remember correctly, it's talking about Israel, the northern kingdom primarily, but also the southern kingdom. And it says, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord is about to bring on them the strong and abundant waters of the Euphrates, even the king of Assyria and all his glory." So in this passage, the glory seems to be his military might, the thing that makes him distinctive. The main thing that makes him stand out is his military might. So it's the army here. And we have a similar reference in Isaiah 16:14. "But now the Lord speaks, saying, within 3 years, as a hired man would count them, the glory of Moab will be degraded along with all his great population and his remnant." The glory of Moab will be degraded along with his great population, and his abundant and his remnant will be very small and impotent. So apparently glory here in these contexts is talking about military might, the thing that makes it stand out. And Assyria, the thing that made the king of Assyria stand out was his military might. So this flame, this fire will start under his glory, under the glory of the king of Assyria. And it will be kindled like a burning flame. And what will be the source of that? It's the light of Israel. The light of Israel would become a fire, and the Holy One a flame. Now this phrase, a Holy One, has appeared several times previously, and it will appear some more in Isaiah. It shows up about a dozen times in Isaiah. And in each time, the context seems to be one in which God is being held up as one who is pure and purely righteous. such that he will not countenance evil. So oftentimes, when it refers to the Holy One, it's in a context of judgment of evil, which would fit in this context in any case, whether it's talking about the disease or something else. It will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in a single day. Thorns and briars is a phrase that we've seen several times in Isaiah, and we will see some more. And up until now, I have just seen thorns and briars as being, he's just talking about everything burning, from the littlest things to the biggest things, from the weeds to the tree, tallest trees. But I started looking back at where this term occurs, and I think there's more significant than that, more than just everything. Let's look back at 5:6. If you'll recall, this is in the context of his parable of the vineyard, where God is likening himself to a vintner, and Israel and Jerusalem as the vineyard, and he went to great care to plant it correctly, to protect it with a wall around it, and he has cared for it ever since it was planted. And yet, it rebelled against him, so he removed his care. Let's see. I'll start in verse 3, just to refresh your memory. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? Why, when I expected it to produce good grapes, did it produce worthless ones? Now let me tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its wall, and it will become trampled ground. I will lay it waste, and it will not be pruned or hoed, but briars and thorns will come up. I will also charge the clouds, rain no rain on it. So the briars and thorns are what appear when God's maintenance ceases. Without God's daily attention, it's briars and thorns that show up, that come up. That is a wonderful metaphor for anyone who lives in the Willamette Valley. I swear, in 4 years' time, if we did not fight the blackberries, our whole property would be overrun with them. They are uniquely designed for survivability and reproduction. So what happens when the care is removed is these come, these things show up. So the briars and thorns then are symbolic of, it seems to me, man in his natural state with God's grace removed. This is what happens. This is the kind of thing that man turns into if God's grace is removed and he's allowed to pursue his own ends in his own way. So I think that Isaiah has created then a symbol here. Briars and thorns is not just doesn't just mean the littlest plant, but it's talking more specifically, more pointedly, the briars and thorns are man's innate rebelliousness against God. Man in his natural state. So this fire is going to burn and devour these thorns and these briars in a single day. And I'm not sure what the significance of in a single day is. He's used that before. In fact, he used it in chapter 9. I'm not going to be able to find it right off. But he, in reference to one of the punishments then, he used the term in a single day. So we're beginning to see some phrases that he's using multiple times that I'm confident have more significance than I have uncovered. So this fire is going to turn into a flame which will devour his thorns and briars in a single day. And he, God, will destroy the glory of his forest, and he's used the term forest before, forest standing for a whole kingdom, a majestic kingdom. Destroy the glory of his forest and of his fruitful garden. He's used the term garden before as well, a few times. Now he switches metaphors on us again, both soul and body. And it will be when a sick man, it will be as when a sick man wastes away. So now we're returning to that other image that he had before when he's talking about a wasting sickness. And the rest of the, and here he's talking about total destruction. It's wasting away. And a sick man, we have, with a man, we have a, something that is unified. A human being is a single entity, and he's likening Assyria to this single entity, which when it works well, it's a great thing, but when the disease afflicts it, it wastes away, falls apart. And the rest of the trees of his forest will be so small in number. So this for this fire is going to reduce this whole forest and the garden into nothing but a few remaining trees, so few that a child could write them down. Okay, so I'm suspicious that he is changing, that the in verse 16 he's talking about two different things, two different but similar things. Both are afflictions that will be sent by God on Assyria, and I'm going to modify that in just a second, for its rebelliousness and arrogance against God. But if they are two different things, then the second one is a more serious and a more devastating punishment that will come upon Assyria. And if that's the case, then it won't, it's something yet to happen, because Assyria ceased to exist. So if it's yet to happen, how can it happen to Assyria? And as we get into the next few verses, I think that there is reason to believe that Isaiah is shifting here a little bit, that he's no longer talking about Assyria. He's not talking about Assyria as a geographical location. He's not talking about Assyria as an ethnic identity, but rather he's talking about Assyria as a spiritual identity. That is, Assyria comes to stand for the spirit of rebelliousness and arrogance before the God of Israel. If that's what he's doing, this is a very subtle little slide, and yet I think we've seen hints of this elsewhere in Isaiah. And I think we'll see hints of it later on. So this is something that you need to file away. And just, I haven't done much rock climbing, so I feel free to use a rock climbing analogy here. But my understanding, the little that I've done, I realize that if you're climbing a rather sheer face, you have no option but to explore every little crack as something that you can possibly use for a finger hold or a foothold. And interpreting Isaiah seems to be that kind of thing. If you're going to go up it, you have to explore every little crack, every little disjunction, to see whether it really is a turn in his train of thought, a slight shift in the direction that his argument is going, or maybe it's a crack that's not usable. It is just poetic license. And that's the choice you have to constantly be making. And so it's a little bit of an acrobatic feat to make it up this cliff. But I sense a crack here. I think there's a little bit of a shift in what he's doing here. Let's look on at verse 20 and see if it becomes clearer then why I think there's a shift. Let me read 20 through 23. Now it will come about in that day that the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them, but will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. For a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord God of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. I think he has to be here talking about something that is yet in the future. He's talking about the remnant of Israel that is going to return to God and will truly rely on the Lord rather than and never again rely on the one who struck them. That's an interesting phrase here. Judah, in order to survive after Israel had been conquered by the Assyrians, Judah allied itself with Assyria for a period of time. Against Isaiah's warnings, Isaiah said, "Don't do it." But the king of Judah did it anyway. And then it was later that Judah rebelled against Assyria, and that's why they were attacked by Sennacherib. And here, what God is saying is, the time is coming when a remnant of Israel will truly rely on God and never again rely on the one who struck them, on Assyria. And though your people, O Israel, okay, so though the number of descendants of Abraham may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant, there's only going to be a small percentage, which will return to God. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. In verse 23, for a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord God of hosts will execute in the midst of the whole land. Now, what is translated here, the whole land, could also be translated the whole earth. Because of what follows in the rest of this chapter, I think that the whole earth would be a better translation. That what it's talking about is a destruction that is going to come over the whole earth. And by the way, the Septuagint agrees on that particular point. It calls it the oikonome, so it's talking about the whole inhabited world, if the Septuagint is right, and I'm right. So what's being decreed then, I think, is a righteous judgment, a destruction that has been set out in advance. God has ordained this to come to pass. There will be a judgment overflowing with righteousness. So a righteous judgment that is going to be a complete destruction, which will be carried out throughout the whole earth. Now verse 24, therefore, thus says the Lord God of hosts, O my people who dwell in Zion, do not fear the Assyrian who strikes you with the rod and lifts up his staff against you, the way Egypt did. For in a very little while, my indignation against you will be spent, and my anger will be directed to their destruction. And the Lord of hosts will arouse a scourge on him like the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. And his staff will be over the sea, and he will lift it up the way he did in Egypt. So it will be in that day that his burden will be removed from your shoulders and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fatness. So the argument of Isaiah here is, don't worry about the Assyrians. Their time is coming. Right now, God is carrying out his judgment on the people of Israel. And I think what fits best here is he's talking about a judgment that's been carried out on the people of Israel over these past two millennia or so, such that a remnant is being, is in formation. He says, don't worry about the Assyrians, because just as when I'm done carrying out my judgment on the people of Israel, then I'm going to direct my attention on the Assyrians. And he likens it to what happened at the slaughter of Midian and what he did in Egypt. The slaughter of Midian is referring back to the time of the judges, when Gideon was raised up as a judge in Israel. God directed him to go out against the Midianites. And so he called for the people, the men of Israel, to assemble. And when they assembled, there were 30,000 some soldiers that showed up ready to fight. And God spoke to Midian and he said, too many. So Gideon said, anybody who doesn't want to fight, go home. And a little over half of them went home. Two-thirds of them went home. There were still 10,000 left. And God said, still too many. So Gideon, at God's direction, told them all to go get a drink at the stream. And they all went to get a drink at the stream, and God directed Gideon to observe which ones knelt down to drink and which ones lapped up the water like a dog. And those that lapped up the water like a dog, he retained, he separated those out. And of those, there were 300. So I guess lapping water like a dog is the less typical way of drinking from a stream. So there were 300 that were remaining. And God said, just right. And it's with those 300 then that Gideon fought against the Midianites, who are described as numerous as the sand. So we have this huge disproportion in armies of a huge Midianite army and 300 Israelites, and the Israelites rout them. So here we have an allusion to that particular event, which makes one suspicious that that's the kind of event that's going to happen when God directs his anger to the destruction of Assyria. He also likens it to what happened, the way he did in Egypt. He will lift it up, that is the staff, the way he did in Egypt. If you recall, when the Israelites left Egypt, it was with signs and wonders. God entered into history in a way that he had never done before, and in a way that he has not done since. He entered into human history and carried out the plagues against the people of Egypt. And then it culminated with him opening up the waters of the Red Sea, when Moses raised his staff over the Red Sea, and the Israelites went through on dry ground. So both of these, likening it to Israel's defeat of the Midianites and likening it to what God did in Egypt, both are pointing to God entering into history when he carries out his anger against the Assyrians in a way that he has not done since the time of Egypt, of the Exodus. And in that day, his burden will be removed from your shoulders and his yoke from your neck, and the yoke will be broken because of fatness. Fatness meaning prosperity and strength. So the picture we have then is the yoke not being removed, but the yoke being burst off because of the strength, the fatness, the strength of of Israel. And it's not talking about, presumably not talking about military strength, but it's talking about a spiritual and moral strength that will allow them to throw the yoke of the Assyrians off the neck. I think when you put all of these clues together, that what it's talking about here is something that is yet to happen. That there is yet to come a destruction of the Assyrians in a way, a complete destruction, a dramatic destruction, in a way that has not yet happened. A defeat of the Assyrians against overwhelming odds, and if a defeat that comes about through God's overt activity. That's why, then, I began to look back at that, at verses 16 through 19, and suspect that in verse 16, God is talking about, first of all, the disease that came upon the Assyrians when they were besieging Jerusalem, such that they had to break the siege and go home. But in the last half of 16, it's switching to a greater and more devastating punishment of Assyria that is yet to come, and that it is talking about in verses 20 through 27. Okay, let me just read this last section, 28 through 34, and make a few comments about it. It has come about that Aiath has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he deposited his baggage. Just a second, let me start over. He has come against Aiath. He has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he deposited his baggage. They have gone through the pass, saying, Geba will be our lodging place. Ramah is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. Cry aloud with your voice, O daughter of Gihon. Pay attention, Laish, and wretched Anunnath. Madmena has fled. The inhabitants of Gabim have sought refuge. Yet today he will halt at Nob. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Behold, the Lord, the God of hosts, will lop off the boughs with a terrible crash. Those also who are tall in stature will be cut down, and those who are lofty will be abased. And he will cut down the thickets of the forest with an iron axe, and Lebanon will fall by the Mighty One. So he's describing here that he apparently is Assyria, the king of Assyria, has come against, and it names the cities of Palestine. And as he moves through Palestine, apparently he is successful and gains confidence and believe this is going to be a cakewalk, and says, Geba will be our lodging place, Ramah is terrified, and Gibeah of Saul has fled away. So things are going well for the king of Assyria. And he's marching through and says, here we come, give up. Yet today he will halt at Nob. So he gets close to Jerusalem and has to stop there. He shakes his fist at the mountain of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Apparently I'm going to get you. But God stops it there. He lops off the boughs with a terrible crash, and those who are tall in stature will be cut down. So God is going to bring him low, even though with all of these successes and the arrogance, he's going to get close, but it will stop, and it will not be ultimately successful. God will enter in and destroy them. Now, if we take these cities as they come, if we assume that what's being described here is the route by which the Assyrians marched towards Jerusalem, the Assyrians did not follow that route. It is possible that there are two times when the Assyrians besieged Jerusalem. But even if that's so, neither time did they follow this route. Both times they came from the opposite direction. So either this is not describing the route, or it's talking about a campaign that has not yet happened. And I'm suspicious of the latter. Okay. I think then what's being argued, let me summarize what I think he's talking about here. He has talked about what, in chapter 9, what Israel and Judah have done to deserve the loving punishment, the redemptive punishment of God. That because of their rebelliousness and various forms of rebelliousness, God is going to enter in and they are going to be punished. And this punishment, at the end of each description of a punishment, Isaiah adds, and his hand is still stretched out. And yet, so the punishment continues. So it's an ongoing thing. So he talks about the punishment that's going to come upon Israel and Judah. Most of that is fulfilled when the Assyrians attack Israel first, and then about 40 years later, attack Judah. But God then turns to Assyria and says, now you are going to be punished. Because of your arrogance and because of your disdain for the God of Israel, I am going to punish you. And God spells out a destruction that is going to come upon Assyria for that arrogance and rebelliousness. But then I think he's taking Assyria and he's seeing that as not just a country, but as a spirit and attitude towards the God of Israel, as something much bigger than just Assyria. And in the future, that spirit is going to come under attack and be punished by God. In the future, yet to come, a remnant will be weeded out, will be drawn out from the nation of Israel. A remnant that is truly devoted to God. And that remnant will be the result of God's continuing activity with the nation of Israel, the descendants of Abraham, for all of these years, for these millennia. And God will have brought about this remnant that is truly, truly relies on God. And his anger then towards Israel will have been spent, and he will turn now towards the spirit of Assyria, the spirit outside of Israel that is arrogant and rebellious against God. And that spirit is going to inhabit, I don't know, some significant number of people on earth. It's when the destruction comes, there are only going to be left the number of trees that a child could number. But that those forces are apparently going to come against Israel, thinking that victory is in their grasp, and God will defeat them against huge odds with an overt show of force on his part. And the end result will be that Israel will be freed from its enslavement to other nations. It will finally be free, liberated by God. Okay. I was thinking about, there's a sense in which these themes are rather repetitive in Isaiah. And they will continue to repeat themselves. We keep getting these same statements with respect to Israel's rebelliousness and the fact that because of that rebelliousness, God is going to inflict a punishment on Israel. He's going to discipline Israel. But out of that, there is going to be a redemption that will take place, and ultimately, for this remnant, there is a glorious future that awaits. These themes keep coming up, and they get very repetitive, and in a sense, they kind of lose their force because they're so repetitive, and because we aren't under siege the way Jerusalem was. But I find something really reassuring. When I just sit back and think about this picture, there's something extremely reassuring about this. And that is, Isaiah is making it extremely clear, and is expressing himself with great confidence, that God has things well in hand, and that righteousness will win out. That ultimately, God is going to make things right. Wickedness will be destroyed, and God will rule over all in righteousness. And keeping that in mind is, I think, very freeing and very reassuring. In our day-to-day lives, there is an enormous tendency for us to put value on things that, in the bigger scope of time, are absolutely trivial. If we think about the things that worry us on a day-to-day basis, if we stand back a millennia or two, they shrink into insignificance. And yet there are other things that we pay relatively little attention to in our day-to-day lives that if we could stand back a millennia or two would loom large. And the knowledge that righteousness will ultimately win out, righteousness will ultimately reign, and righteousness is ultimately the important and valuable thing, really helps put things into perspective. That to pursue righteousness is not a futile endeavor. To pursue righteousness is to pursue that which will endure forever. It will be to be, we will be pursuing citizenship in that kingdom without end. Questions or comments?
I didn't have a Bible handy to follow along with you, so I'm not sure if I'm remembering this correctly. But it seemed to me you read something that talked about, referred to God's promise to Abraham that he would have descendants as of the sands of the sea or something like that. But then it said, though your descendants be as the sand of the sea, there'll be only a remnant left, or something to that effect. It seemed to be in connection with the tree, you know, burning up the forest and only the child could count it. Am I remembering correctly? My question is, I guess when God promised to Abraham that your descendants would be as the sand of the sea, I assumed he meant his spiritual descendants, that that ultimately, although the number of people who've ever lived on the earth is going to be a huge number, that there will still ultimately be a significant number of people who would be saved. And that's part of God's promise to Abraham. Now, it sounds like God's promise to Abram actually meant his physical descendants, and that the number of people who actually would be saved ultimately is going to be very small. I guess I'd always rationalized it that the word remnant it just refers to a portion. Mm-hmm. So even if you start out with 6 gazillion people, mm-hmm. 10% of that would still be a whole heck of a lot of people.
Okay.
But now I'm wondering if, does it sound to you like Isaiah is saying that the ultimate number of people who are going to be saved is going to be tiny by anybody's estimation?
Where it's talking about the remnant, the remnant is not the same as the standing trees after the forest fire. the trees that are standing after the forest fire, that's what remains when Assyria is devastated by this, what I think is a bigger judgment, a bigger destruction than the wasting disease. So that's what's the small number. The remnant that it talks about, it doesn't talk about it in numerical terms. It just says, "For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant within them will return." So I don't think it's giving us, I don't think we have much to go on to come up with percentages.
So the sand of the sea there, do you think that's a reference back to God's promise to Abraham, or it's just using that metaphor again to say, even though you've got lots of people, only a fraction of them will return?
I think it's the latter. I don't know if it's the former. But here I think it's just, it's not uncommon for that phrase to be used. If I remember correctly, that same phrase is used in Judges when it's describing the size of the army of the Midianites, that it was like the sand of the sea. So I don't know that that expression, it seems to me that that's a common expression indicating beyond number, a huge number. And all we know is that the people of Israel were like the sand of the sea, but by contrast, only a remnant will return to God. So 50%, 2%, I don't know.
Do you have an opinion on when God said to Abraham, your descendants will be as the sand of the sea, whether he was referring to his physical descendants or his spiritual descendants?
I don't know.
David, do you have a sense of how this was delivered to the people of Israel? Did Isaiah get up and read it in front of the temple? Was it in a series of talks? Was it just written down?
I don't know. It says at the very beginning, verse 1 of Isaiah says, "The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah." That is one long vision. Some people argue that when it talks about this vision, it's just talking about the initial, I think they say the first five chapters of Isaiah. Because in chapter 6 it says, "In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, lofty and exalted," etc., etc. So here's a specific vision. So I don't really know, and I don't, and the people who know more than I do say various things. My sense, however, is that what we probably have here is a compilation of visions that he received over a very long period of time that he has just compiled into one literary, and how these were delivered to the people of Jerusalem and of Judah at the time, I don't know. There is an account of Isaiah walking through the streets wearing only sackcloth, and the context is he's saying, don't ally yourself with the Assyrians. If you do, you're going to end up poor and naked and suffering. Does anybody remember? I think that's the context. So he did actively prophesy and wore appropriate garb for his prophecy as well. So he did some of that. And he apparently spent a lot of time speaking individually to the kings of Israel. There seems to be quite a bit of evidence of that. But as far as how these were delivered to the people of Israel, I don't know. But as you read through them, you really get the sense of these being somewhat separate things. That there are some pretty sharp breaks between sections, it seems to me. That's all I can do. Stan?
Could you remind me again about the division of the people of God, of Israel? We're using the terms Israel, Judah, and Jerusalem, and I know there's a split with a north and a south nation, and I'm not certain as to which are the people of God and when we can appropriately interchange these terms, and or if some of the people of God are in each or either nation.
Right. The nation split after the death of Solomon, and Judah and Benjamin, those two tribes, they gave their allegiance to the descendant of Solomon, Rehoboam, I think his name was. So they became then a separate entity. The rest of the tribes all threw their allegiance behind Jeroboam, the king in the north. So that's why it is called Israel, is because the majority of tribes went with the rebel. So the northern kingdom becomes called Israel. The southern kingdom is called Judah. The kingdom in the north, Israel. As you go through reading in 1st and 2nd Kings, the kings are consistently says that they did evil in the sight of God. They are consistently bad. Some worse, and some slightly less bad, but they were all bad. In Judah, it is more of a mixed bag, that we have some bad kings and we have some about whom it says that they walked with God. It says that they were basically good. Isaiah is a prophet in Judah, the capital of which is Jerusalem. Israel, at the beginning of the time that Isaiah is talking about, is a separate entity and is at this particular time a thriving country. But it allied itself with Syria against the Assyrians, and it wanted Judah to join into that alliance, which Judah would not do. And so Israel turned against Judah. Then we have, because of that alliance, the Assyrians come in and they conquer Israel, and they take a number of the people from Israel into exile. So by the time that the Assyrians attack Judah and besiege Jerusalem, Israel has ceased to be a nation, has ceased to be a kingdom. It's completely under the control of Assyria. So where are the people of God? To the extent that there is a population that is devoted to the worship of Yahweh in an organized fashion, it's only in Judah, it's not in Israel. Are there people who are devoted to Yahweh in Israel? Probably. But it's they are apparently few and far between, if they exist.
The destruction overflowing with righteousness,
mm-hmm.
since you reminded me of it.
Yes.
Is that saying them's that get it deserve it?
I don't...
Is it okay? Well, this is going to sound silly, but is it okay for God to be so intolerant of evil that He destroys it, or those who are devoted to it? Is it okay for God?
Yeah.
I mean, is that part of what it means to be righteous?
To destroy those who are unrighteous.
Yeah.
Is this a trick question?
Well, no. I mean, we have we seem to have this. A lot of people have a real cosmic muffin view of God, and that what it means for God to be righteous is that He just sits around thinking good thoughts, you know, and He just loves everybody and et cetera, et cetera. But is it to me? It seems like it's not incompatible for Him to look at, say, our world, and when He sees school children combining their pennies to send to a relief organization, he goes, that's really nice. And he sees people like, the current bad guy would be Slobodan Milosevic and his thugs and his rapists, that if God comes out of His chair and just gets really angry and just starts squashing them like bugs, that too is His love of goodness. That too is His love of goodness and tolerance of evil. It's the same. Is that the same thing? And do we need to maybe expand our view of God to include that?
Yeah, I think what it's talking about when it says that this destruction is determined is that God is going to move in such a way that righteousness will be established on earth through the destruction of all unrighteousness in the sense of any challenge to that righteousness. So I think right here it's talking about, in political terms in a sense, that all power bases of unrighteousness will be eliminated. The only thing left standing will be a power base of righteousness. And it's in that what I'm talking about, the spirit of Assyria, will be absolutely crushed and destroyed.
So the overflowing, it seems to me that he's replacing it with something. I mean, it's not just the elimination of something, it's the
It's the elimination of unrighteousness and the establishment of righteousness,
which is going to take up more space. I mean, it sounds kind of silly, but I get this picture of in comes this wave of really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just, okay, I'm going to take out the 9 out of 10 bad things and leave only that remaining 10% to occupy, the remaining, all that void. But man, something's coming that is just going to fill this space in the wake of this destruction with goodness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Are you talking about numbers of people when you talk about space? Or because my conception of righteousness is that it's kind of big. That it seems to me that righteousness is of such a nature that it will fill whatever room it's in. I don't know. One more.
I had a question regarding the remnant.
Uh-huh.
Here it seems to be saying that, like, ultimately, out of all of Israel, a remnant will be saved, like in the ultimate sense of, like, the end times, maybe. Mm-hmm. But then, like, in Romans, like, 11, I've heard Jack teach about that a remnant will exist throughout the ages, and then ultimately all of Israel will be saved, like down to every last one.
Hmm.
And I'm just curious about that, if I'm talking about two different things, or you just disagree or whatever.
I just don't know. I don't know. I think what it's describing here is an entity will come into being, and I assume it is Israel, and in the geographical location of Israel, an entity will come into being, which will be inhabited by descendants of Israel who truly rely upon the Lord. And it will be a remnant by contrast to all of the Jews that have lived, that there will be some subset of that. And I don't know whether that's all of the Jews that live on the earth at the time, or whether it's just some of them. I don't know. The answers to those kinds of questions, I don't know. Okay, thanks.